Hello and welcome to the Bagel Podcast with me, Hayden Cohen. Happy 2020 and congrats to those who've just finished their 7.5 year Daf Yomi Talmud cycle, where you learn a page of Talmud every day. I'm attempting the new cycle myself, and as the Shmerel of Talmud for Shmerels, hopefully it'll make me less Shmerely. Whether I'll get to the end is another matter. Since the last episode, I've been to Limud Festival in Birmingham, and it was a whole load of fun. While you were eating donuts or Christmas pudding or both, I don't judge, I ran 3 bagel podcast sessions, a performance poetry workshop for teenagers, a successful first live reading of my book Camp Mazel, where every day you get lucky, out in shops in the next century or so, some passable stand-up and a rather enjoyable time on the Jewification game. Over the coming months, you'll hear lots of content recorded there. A big thanks to everyone at Limud. Their scope and scale still baffles me. If you've joined us since Limud, Shalom Aleichem. Welcome to the fun. Anyway, enough of this loving. Here's what's coming up on today's show. I keep on mispronouncing the rice dish Mechadra with Miri Lewis. Gilad Halpin provides us with an Israel update. Now they're heading to the third election within a year. Talmud for Shmerels is led by Rabbi Benji Stanley, who discusses what the Talmud says about being nice to each other, which perfectly complements our Bagel Broigus recorded in Manchester about if/how we can remain friends with people we disagree with. On the panel, we have media man Simon Jacobs, Yehudis Fletcher, who combats extremism within the Haredi community, and the Brexit Party candidate for Salford, Matt Mickler. But first, it's time for Beverly Jane Stewart, an artist whose main focus is on the synagogue experience. I'm in a rabbit warren in the middle of St. John's Wood to see Beverly Jane Stewart and her amazing studio and her artwork. Hello, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for coming in and coming to my little private world, which is actually I try to reach out to other people too. But here is a place that the creation actually is formed.
I can just to kind of paint the picture, literally, around us are, how many paintings are here?
Well, a lot of these paintings are reproduction because I have got at the moment 30 pictures have just gone to Israel for an exhibition at Tel Aviv University. So I've reproduced a lot so the studio doesn't look too bare, but there are still some originals here, and there's lots of sketch works, and I'm also a printmaker, so there's lots of other things. And also there's a new work that I'm doing when I've been working in Romania, which is now going to be shown, launched in London, going to Tel Aviv, and then be part of the EU Festival of Culture, all starting this next year in September. So this is new work floating around the studio at the moment.
You have this style that, you know what, I'll let you explain the style.
Let me start with how it began and then explain to you how it developed. I'm looking at synagogues, not necessarily as a place of prayer, but as a place of a community where people meet together and can identify as being a Jew in a building. So it's looking at it completely differently. And it started with my own synagogue was closing, Brixton. There'd been riots in the area. There'd been a lot of racial tension. And I loved going to this place, sitting upstairs with my mother. And I did this picture of my personal perspective and view of the synagogue from where I sat with my mother. And this picture caused a lot of interest. And then I started doing more synagogues, but playing with the perspective.
Why did that cause interest? What was interesting about that?
I think because of the individuality of the style. Also, I'd already started playing with the perspective and opening up so people feel they're coming into the service, engulfing into the service, connecting to the service or the atmosphere of the community and the different characters within it. I'm not really showing individuals or portraits of individuals. It's more characterization of groups and what people wear and how their body movement and their language within the body and how people meet and group up. Once I moved from the synagogue interior, I started thinking about outside the synagogue. In my latest work, it's about the relationship between private life and public life. So when you go into a building and you connect with your Judaism, you then come out into a much more multicultural, mixed world. And it's all about how you adapt to that. Also, why was a synagogue in a specific place? Often the trade people put in, the businesses people put in, the connection the Jewish people had with the society around them. So they became an asset and they connected. And then sometimes synagogues dwindled, people moved away. And what was the legacy left? So there's all these sort of things that I'm looking at, and it's social history connected with the synagogue.
Should we go through some of the paintings?
Yeah. I mean, it's a matter of which ones you want to choose.
You know what? I know I should say Leeds because I'm from Leeds. Right. However, I'm also in the entertainment biz. So let's do Blackpool.
Right. This painting was based on the last ceremony at Blackpool Synagogue. But also I'm trying to show why that synagogue came about. And it was purely to do with the entertainment business. Blackpool was known for its entertainment for people that had a day off from the mills. They came from Manchester, they came to Blackpool, and there was all these fun rides, and there was the circus and the life on the pier. And it became a very vibrant place. And so Jews came a lot from Manchester and set up stalls in the market, did bed and breakfast, B&Bs, opened up hotels, were part of the big entertainments. They was one of the first fairs and also circus that they started investing in. So they had a big impact in Blackpool. And that picture shows you the history of that entertainment world. But what did the synagogue connection have? And the synagogue itself actually was very plain, but the stained glass windows, which is a form of visual entertainment in a place of worship, were very colourful, very prominent, and that you can see quite strong in that painting. So this is the last service, and at the side you see all this history of the entertaining world. And then at the very end of the picture, the ark is emptied, the Torahs are taken out, and they're transported to St Anne's, which still has a Jewish community, and that Blackpool community moved to St Anne's. So it's a transgression. It's a, you know, it's a time of entertainment, and then the synagogue being vibrant, and then now it's moved on to St Anne's.
I think you're almost underselling it, because there's, just to try and explain, on the right you've got everything that you would associate with Blackpool. So roller coasters, the Blackpool Tower, piers that are done in, what style is that on the...
Well, there are three different piers, actually. At the very end, there are people bathing on the beach with the horses. And then it comes into sort of the Victorian pier. And then it comes into the pier, which is between the wars, and then what the pier is like today. So it moves in, you know, there's more than one pier there, more than one scene. It moves in time from the Victorian impact, and then more into pre-war, and then just at the end of the post-war, when it was at its peak.
But I can't see any arcade machines, so...
You have to look really closely.
Should we do one more?
Why not go to Leeds? Because that's quite a really interesting theme on that one. This was based on Chapel Town Synagogue that closed and now has become the Northern Dance School, Modern Dance School. And when I went there, I was very interested because, first of all, it's a listed building. So a lot of the architectural details that you would connect with the synagogue are still prevalent. So you still got the foundation stones in Hebrew. You still got the chandelier up there, still some of the stained glass windows and the pews. And the En Kodesh, the ark, is right at the back. And you can actually see the shape of the interior architecture there when you go and explore the place. So these people that are using this place as a dance school are actually in an atmosphere that has a history of being a synagogue, and you still can feel that history. And when I approached the lecturers, they all knew it was a synagogue. They were all very proud of it being a synagogue. And for me, that was really special. And then I wanted to take it one stage further. What is a synagogue meant to be? It's meant to be a place of prayer. has meant a place where you want good things to happen. It's a benevolent place. It's people give good things, like give to charity. You know, it's meant to be a place that's spiritually uplifting. And though the people have moved away as a synagogue, I felt it left that spiritual legacy in that area, because this place is now in an area, it has slightly improved, but only in recent years, there was a knife crime. There was drugs in this area. And here was a school that let people use a platform to express their problems, their fears, in a way that was accepted. So it was using a building and the use of dance as a way of making something good in society. And I also wanted to show, in the smaller picture, it focuses much more on this theme. I've got the Hasidim there, and people say, well, what's the Hasidim doing with a dance school? And probably they'd have a shot, I did it. But it was about the Hasidim brought in the importance not of words in prayer, but movement in prayer. And it was this link of being able to express through movement your emotions, which was capturing me. And then I wanted to show how much did these expressions of movement express the deprivation they felt in the street. So you see graffiti in the street scene, you see the people in their cars, the wandering around. All this scene I experienced because I wandered around there and I felt the community. All my pictures are never done from a distance. I have to go, I have to be connected to it to express those emotions and feelings that I put into my work.
The attention to detail is pretty astounding, because I know this area very well.
Right.
You know, going past it a million times growing up.
Yeah.
Even to the, you know, the Nelson Mandela Community Centre, and that's yeah. quite a stark image that yes. you can't miss going through there. What's the there's a cityscape on the top right.
Well, it's showing modernity. In fact, interestingly enough, with this particular picture, if you look at the picture, the building goes off the page.
Yeah.
And the reason I did that was, it's never ending. Modernity will always continue. The modern world will always develop, and you can't stop that. So it's an ongoing. I like to feel work goes beyond the image, beyond the picture. And in a way, that was a symbol of what I felt about the modern place. And if you look at modern Leeds today, it's full of these very modern buildings. But in Chapel Town, there's still the back-to-back houses. So I've got those back-to-back houses. And in the distance, in the backdrop, you see the modern skyscrapers. And on the left, you see that's the outside of the synagogue. So I show the outside within the, so you see it inside as well. So it's like you've sliced the building. So that's how to link the old with the new.
And random irrelevant trivia, my parents got married in that show.
Oh, did they?
Yes.
Nice.
Thanks, Beverly. And there should be some photos up on the episode page on bagelpodcast.com. Now for our Israel update, it's Gilad Halpin.
What is really going on?
So I'm joined once again by Gilad Halpin across the seas, across the other side of Europe, in Eretz Yisrael, in Tel Aviv. How are you doing, Gilad?
I'm very well. How are you, Hayden?
Yeah, good, 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 good. Just getting pumped for some Israel news that's going to be... I'm pumped for it. I'm ready. What have you got for us?
Well, you know, after the election, the general election that you had, I told my British friends that I will no longer allow them to badmouth Israeli politics.
I realised about a month ago that whatever the outcome would be of the British election, I was going to be depressed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly that. So welcome to our world. What can I say?
Right, so, British politics, I know quite a bit about. Israeli politics, thanks to you, I'm getting to know more. I know there's been a bit of a brawl that's ended up in everyone getting a bloodied nose and no one actually being declared the winner. Am I right?
Yeah, pretty much. It's been going on for a while now. Israel has been without a functioning government for a year now, and with no end in sight. The nearest deadline is probably 6 months down the road, which is quite a long time. And that is if everything goes according to plan, which it probably won't. Israel, as we know, of the last few days, is going to the polls again for the third time in under a year. So the elections will probably take place on the 2nd of March, 2020. After the last elections in September failed, as you said, to yield a clear winner. And basically both camps, each a few seats short of a majority in parliament, were unable to join forces and coalesce, quite literally form a coalition. And the thing is that, according to Israeli electoral law, one of the candidates most likely to be able to form a government is entrusted by the president to try and do so for a period of a few weeks. If he fails, he returns the mandate to the president, and the president decides to give it to another person who is now best disposed to do so. The first one was Benjamin Netanyahu, who failed, and then Benny Gantz, who was given the same amount of time, who also failed. And in that event, the mandate goes back to the Knesset, to the newly elected Knesset. And according to the law, the sitting MKs are supposed to come up with a candidate that they agree on to form a government. They failed to do that as well. And therefore, by the end of that period, another few weeks that ended on Wednesday, the 10th of December, I think, the law says that the Knesset automatically dissolves itself and new elections are called.
Can I ask, because it just seems from a kind of outsider's perspective, on the kind of political spectrum, there isn't masses between Benny Gantz and Bibi Netanyahu in terms of where they sit on the spectrum. I realise there's a lot of history and all this type of thing. They're both centre-right, right?
Yeah. No, the thing is that they... Traditionally, Netanyahu has been to the right of centre, so he wasn't, a rabid right-winger, and he's turned into one or someone resembling one over the last few years because he thought it would be able to capitalize on politically. So he's moved to the right in recent years. The centrist party, that Gantz's party, is also, I'd say, slightly right of center. Gantz himself strikes me as someone who's more left of center, but it doesn't really matter because his party is also the platform is really right of center. And as I said, for a long time, since actually the formation of the different parties that started Blue and White, it's actually a one party composed of several factions, they are all, in America, there are never Trump Republicans, right? So they are all never Bibi Likudniks. So on every other issue, or most of the other issues, except Netanyahu's demeanor and also his what seems to be like his criminal record, and to what extent it disqualifies him from being from serving as prime minister, there's actually very few dissimilarities between them. And I think, and this is something that my colleague Angel Pfeffer has written about in her several times, that once Netanyahu is out of the picture, the political landscape in Israel is probably going to undergo major, well, I wouldn't say major, but a serious overhaul with political forces realigning in a different way to what we see now.
So my question is, do you think then on a kind of voting level, if you break down where each party is on the spectrum, because Israel has proportional representation and effectively you can vote for whichever party you like the best, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that means that Israel's going to go further right, or do you think it's going to have an equilibrium that's more centrist, or where do you think it's going to go? Like what?
That's a good question, because the electorate is clearly right-wing. There has been for a long time now a majority for right-wing parties in parliament. New polls have showed that the center-left is likely to garner a majority even without the Arab parties that are, you know, to an extent in the center-left camp, but not really considered as viable coalition partners. But it's enough to block a right-wing majority. And I think that once Netanyahu is out of the picture, there are many, well, not many, but there are some crucial votes that have gone to centrist parties that might go back to Likud and other right-wing parties.
So can I just check then? Is Netanyahu, is he going to actually just go, or is he going to fight a third election?
He is going to fight a third election. That doesn't mean that he's not going to go at the same time. Or the more pertinent question is, when exactly Netanyahu is going to go? Because it is the end game for him. That's pretty certain. He has been indicted with three counts of very serious corruption charges. And the question is whether, I mean, this is really a constitutional question and an unprecedented one, because no Israeli prime minister has ever been indicted while still in office. There was one former prime minister, Netanyahu's predecessor, who was charged and actually jailed eventually. He resigned from office to fight the legal battle, which Netanyahu has persistently refused to do. So it new constitutional questions crop up now, and it's only a matter of time until the constitutional authorities, in this case, the High Court of Justice is one, and the president of the State of Israel is another, who will weigh in and say whether it is even constitutionally valid for someone like Netanyahu to even seek the mandate of prime minister again. Until that happens, Netanyahu is definitely vying to fight a third election. He might have more trouble at home this time, at home being his own party, Likud, because for the first time in, I don't remember how many years, there is a rather strong challenger trying to unseat him. That is his former minister, Gideon Sa'ar, who was in the making for a long time. It was quite clear that he was eyeing the Likud leadership after Netanyahu, and is relatively popular within the party.
But two Brutus, only now, right?
Not so much, because he knew that coming out against Netanyahu before he was finished might do a disservice to his own campaign and leadership aspirations. And he actually said publicly that he's planning to challenge Netanyahu on the day that Netanyahu was indicted. He said enough a minute before. There are going to be party primaries in Likud, and up until now, it was sort of a rubber stamp, because everybody knew that Netanyahu was virtually the only candidate, and all they had to do is just vote to renew his nomination. But now Saar is planning to mount a serious campaign against Netanyahu that Netanyahu will have to fight. I think, and as other pundits have said, that Netanyahu's position is quite secure within his party, so it's probably going to win it, but it's not going to be a walk in the park for him as it was before. And, you know, add to that all his legal woes and the fact that, you know, he's not a winner anymore. There have been two elections that he fought for Likud and was unable to form a government. And Saar, his challenger, says that the reason Netanyahu has failed to form a coalition is not because there aren't enough right-wing votes in parliament, but because of his really sour relations with Gantz's party, first of all, Blue and White, that are composed of Netanyahu's former coalition partners, who were completely disillusioned by him and refused to even mar another coalition arrangement with him. And Avigdor Lieberman, on the other hand, has also been toying with Netanyahu for a long time, and refuses to enter a coalition under him. And Saar says, it's only because of Netanyahu's personality. It's not really about Likud or anything that has to do with policies. And I think he's right. If there's any other person chairing Likud, there could be a Likud-led coalition quite easily.
Just before we wrap up, how many elections can Israel have until they have a new government?
Well, I think that we can go on forever.
Maybe I can ask another question. Is Israel going to get a new government before everything to do with Brexit is done, dusted and resolved?
I was just going to say that. Let's see what comes first, Brexit or a new Israeli government. Who knows? I mean, the thing is that now we're going to a third election in under a year. Someone wrote on Twitter, I don't think that's true, that I don't know if it's true, that the only democracy in history that held three elections in under a year was the Weimar Republic in 1932 and
1933. Oh, no.
So,
oh, that's dark.
Yeah, so who knows, really? The thing is that everybody said after the second vote that also yielded undecisive results is that third election is really out of the question. And all the leaders of the main parties are going to do whatever it takes to form a coalition. Part of the reason was that Netanyahu was apparently acting in bad faith because he knows that is now his survival is hinged on the fact that there's no really new government, no function in Knesset, because until a new government is sworn in, he is the caretaker prime minister. And as such, he is immune by law from being indicted, or at least having to resign. And also, he has ministerial immunity that only a functioning Knesset committee could vote to remove. Now, until the new Knesset is sworn in and a new government is sworn in and the Knesset actually takes up all its legislative duties, there's no relevant Knesset committee to actually vote on Netanyahu's immunity. So he, actually, this is the best scenario for him, this, you know, to be stuck in limbo and, you know, not having to account for his serious legal trouble. You have to buy into that. You really have to believe that Netanyahu is really a self-serving cynic that really holds the entire country hostage.
You don't believe that, right?
Of course not. Of course not. I don't think there would be anyone in the right mind who would think that any Israeli prime minister would act like that. You really have to be a cynic to believe that.
And neither of us are cynics, right?
Of course not, no.
Before we wrap up, is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, well, I think that we're going to do this ad infinitum, Hayden. Like, whenever I come on, like every month or two, to talk about the looming Israeli elections, and you'll talk about the Brexit vote that might or might not pass in Parliament.
Gilad Halpern, thank you very much.
Thank you, Hayden.
Thanks, Gilad. And from the finger on the pulse to cooking pulses, seamless segue if I do say so myself, it's Miri Lewis. So back again with Miri for some more tasty goodness. What are we up to today?
Today we are going to make mujadra, which is a Middle Eastern rice and lentils dish. It sounds simple, but it is probably one of the tastiest things. And you're going to love it.
Let's go.
I've sliced up three onions and I've weighed out 250 grams of basmati rice and 150 grams of brown lentils. You can use brown lentils or green lentils. They've got to be the kind of lentils that don't disintegrate, so not like a red lentil, for example. So the first thing to do is we're just going to heat some oil in a frying pan. And we're going to add the onions to this. One thing I'm going to do, which is going to help with frying the onions and getting the colour, is I'm going to add a teaspoon of salt to the onions. And salt, it draws out the liquid in the onion so that they cook faster and caramelise more. So the onions are going to take about 15 to 20 minutes to caramelise. So what we're going to do while these are cooking is we're going to cook the lentils. And so in a large saucepan, we put in the lentils, and then we're going to add a litre of cold water. And in theory, this has all been perfectly timed and perfectly measured, so everything will be ready at the same time. So the lentils have now come up to the boil, and the onions are kind of halfway to brown, so I'm now going to set a timer for 10 minutes, by which time everything should start being ready. The onions will be ready a bit before then, but there's a few little magic steps we need to do to the onions before we combine everything together. Now that the onions are half caramelised, I'm going to add in a teaspoon of cumin seeds and a teaspoon of coriander seeds, which I've ground up in my pestle and mortar. Not all Mojadra recipes have got spicing in them, but I really, really like it with a bit of spice. And I like using whole spices that you grind yourself instead of using powder, because I just feel like it has a better flavour. And you see maybe like a little fleck. It's great. So now the onions have cooked down quite a lot. You can see they've reduced loads and loads. They've gone brown. They're starting to crisp and catch a little bit on the bottom of the pan. It's delicious and tasty. At this stage, I'm going to add into the pan the rice that we weighed out, which is 250 grams of basmati rice. We're also going to add the secret ingredient that makes this Mojadra amazing, a knob of butter.
Mm.
Because butter makes everything better. Obviously, if you want to have this dairy-free and vegan, you can use margarine, which is extra olive oil. But I really recommend you try it with butter, because it's amazing. So I'm just going to stir this around until the butter melts and the rice is going to toast ever so slightly. What I'm also going to do at this point is add in a ton of black pepper. Well, notice I haven't added any salt yet.
Oh wow, that is a lot.
Yeah, like a lot. I'm going to add the salt now. And the reason why I didn't is that people say that you shouldn't add salt to lentils because it toughens them. So, but now, by the time we add the rice to the lentils will be mostly cooked. They'll be cooked enough so that the salt won't be a problem. So I'm just going to add the salt, like another teaspoon of salt, into the pan with the rice and the onions and the butter. So the lentils have had 10 minutes. So I'm just going to keep stirring this around until the butter has melted. And I think already what we're starting to see is, even though essentially we've got three base ingredients, lentils, rice and butter, but it's already starting to be like, oh, this is actually going to be something amazing.
I'm looking forward to it.
What we do now is we just tip all of the rice mixture into the saucepan with the lentils in. I think also, just in terms of budgeting, this is going to make a lot of portions of food. At least four, if not six, depending on how hungry people are and what else you're eating. There's actually not very much in terms of ingredients, and they're all ingredients that are quite cheap. So this is a really good budget recipe. So I'm just going to mix it all together, and then when it's back up at boil again, which it is now, we just put the lid on and let it simmer. So we let it simmer for another 10 minutes. But, you know, as with all of these things, it's not entirely precise. We're going to need to check it every now and again, see if the water's absorbed or not. It's so the time is just a kind of guidance. But it's been about 10 minutes on a low simmer, and then we'll give it a check and see if it's ready. And while we wait, I think we should make some tahina, because you cannot have Mojadra without tahina or chopped salad, which we will also. So there are lots of different ways of turning raw tahina paste into a tahina sauce, and this is how I do it. We start off with putting in a bowl, a few tablespoons of raw tahina paste, and to this I'm going to add some hot water. I'm going to add like a little bit and keep stirring until, if you've got any kind of lumps, like with this, because it was the end of a tub of tahina, it had gone a bit solid at the bottom, So now that with the water we've made like almost like kind of stirring, it's gone like slightly lighter in colour, it's gone quite creamy. What we're going to do now is add some lemon. And what lemon does is it will seize the tahina, but you just keep stirring, add more water if you need to, and then it will all go creamy and delicious again. I, where possible, use fresh lemon because it just tastes so much better. You can see like as I'm stirring it's starting to kind of seize up a little bit. But because I did all the water first, it's not as bad, and that's why I usually do the water before I do the lemon juice. So it's about half a lemon plus a bit extra from the other half for what was about 4 or 5 tablespoons of tahina. What I'm also going to add is I'm going to add some salt, about half a teaspoon. I'm going to add some garlic powder. You can use fresh garlic, but just sometimes fresh garlic can be quite overpowering, and it's also a bit of a pain to wash up, so I'm adding some garlic powder. This is like garlic granules or garlic powder, whatever you happen to have. It's a quite useful thing. And I'm gonna add a teaspoon of maple syrup. I don't want it to taste like maple syrup, but just like a tiny bit. Just makes it sweet and delicious. So there we've got the lovely, the consistency is like almost like yogurt. You can actually add yogurt into the tahina at the stage, which then is also delicious. I'm going to just keep it simple. And then obviously now, if we were having chopped salad, we would prepare that as well. So we're just going to let it rest for a little bit off the heat. And in about 5 minutes, I think it'll be ready to have a taste. Yeah.
My favourite bit.
One of the things that we're going to do when we taste is we're going to put some crispy fried onions on the top. So we can make these ourselves, but I really didn't want to be intensively frying even more onions just in terms of smelling out the house. And so I just bought a big packet of crispy fried onions, which we have in a jar, which we use as croutons.
Mm.
Things like that, and it's just these sprinkled on top of the majadra. It's add that little crunchy element that you just really need, and very tasty. So you ready for a taste?
I am ready for a taste.
Okay, so I'm letting it sit for a bit. I'm just going to give it a bit of a stir.
That does look really good.
Yeah, it looks great, right?
Right, folks, so I am now going to try this. I will let you know afterwards because I am not going to attempt to eat this whilst I am wearing headphones, an audio recorder, an expensive microphone. So, bye-bye. That was incredibly tasty. Majadra. It's called one of those. We can't quite agree on how to pronounce. Someone write in. Just email in how to pronounce. But that was very, very nice. And so easy. I keep on saying this every time, but I actually probably will give that a go because it's the magic of batches. So you can make it for quite a while. Does it freeze?
I think so.
Yeah, great. Even better. Miri Lewis, thank you very much. I wasn't making it up. That really was excellent mahadra, and it did seem pretty easy to make, although I think that might just be the talent of Miri. So usually at this point we'd have Talmud for Schmerls, but Rabbi Benji Stanley has a message of togetherness, which makes a wonderful antidote to today's Broigus. So I'm going to switch things up a little bit, and now it's time for the Broigus.
The Bagel Broigus!
So I am in Manchester, somewhere outside of Northwest London. There is such a place as outside of Northwest London to record the Broigus for this episode, which is in the context of the Jewish community becoming ever more polarised in our opinions, especially in the realm of an upcoming general election. How do we remain friends at the end of it? If we do. I am joined by 20-something Simon Jacobs, who's a serial entrepreneur as well as part-time lecturer in digital marketing. He runs a group called Professional Weirdos, which is an interesting title, and is politically open-minded. I feel like everyone thinks they're open-minded. Anyway, no one goes, oh, I'm closed-minded. Do this? Maybe some people do think they're closed-minded. Anyway, we might get onto that. Yehudis Fletcher, who is an ISVA, Independent Sexual Violence Advisor at Migdal Emuna and founder of Nahamu, a think tank examining extremism in the Jewish community and studying social policy at Salford University. And to round it off, Matt Mickler, who's a recruitment agent, keen technophile and gamer. He wishes he could have travelled more. Oh, and is Salford's candidate for the Brexit Party. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Hi.
Hello. Hi, thank you for
good
having
afternoon.
Us. So, how do you differentiate between an opinion that it's okay for someone to differ on and one that it's not?
Can I answer this one? So this is a question that came up recently at a panel that I was on. It was a room full of people working in counter-extremism. And for me, the bottom line is, are you crossing a criminal line? So are you putting forward a position that actually, we've got down in legislation as that's, we all agree as a country that it's not okay to do that. So that comes into the context that I was discussing on the previous panel was relationship and sex education, where parents were saying, these are our values should be respected. And the government saying, well, actually, we think you ought to be doing something else. So what I say is, where do we draw the line between what's an opinion that should be respected and what's a boundary that we as a society should enforce? And that is, well, we should start by looking at current legislation, what you're actually allowed to do in this country and what you're not allowed to do.
That's presuming that the law's all fine. Mm.
Well, it is presuming that the laws are all fine, but we have to start somewhere. Now, there's loads. Like, if you ask me what legislation I'd like to introduce, I could talk to you all day, but that's a good starting point.
I think opinions aren't always respected. I think also opinions are encouraged to be given. And I think personally that there will never be a time where everyone's opinion is always going to be accepted and acknowledged and taken on board. But I do think we are in an age now where we need to be voicing our opinions more. There's a lot of people that are afraid to speak.
That's really interesting. So I have this big objection. So I am a Facebook addict, like seriously, addict. And I click on the poster status and it says, what's on your mind? And honestly, would we not be in a better place as a world if we just stopped answering that question so much? That sometimes, is it not better to just bite your tongue sometimes on certain issues? Yes. Certain issues, it's right to speak up, but certainly if it's going to cause... Sometimes you want to cause a ruckus, but do you always want to cause a ruckus? Is there a time to just shut up?
Of course there is. Of course there is. It depends really how offended you want to make somebody as well. And if whether your opinions are valid, are they relevant, are they contextual? There is a lot of, in my opinion, I think there's a lot of, we need to voice our opinions more, but not in the way that it's going to potentially offend anybody or upset anybody. I think, again, it's about context. But I do believe, I know you're saying about the Facebook side of things, I'm certainly a Facebook addict. I think it kind of develops a bit of narcissism in people as well, the amount of things they post. And it really depends. For me, I love Facebook. I think it's connected to people that I've not seen in years. It keeps me up to date with people in real time. I can voice my opinions. I'm a proper keyboard warrior. That's why I've gone into politics. But certainly on the opinion side, I'm not afraid to voice my opinions, but I'd like to be courteous. I'd like to listen to other people's point of view. I would never force my opinions on anybody else. And I think that's where the problem is. I think sometimes you can be a little bit too preachy. You can expect people to think like you. And if they don't think like you, God help them.
So social media has completely changed the way that we communicate. It used to be that people thought things and then they had a conversation. Mm. And now Facebook asks you, well, what's on your mind? Well, if you ask me what's on my mind, you hear this, like, I'll be like, how long have you got? Right? And now we're in this situation where we have reams and reams of people's thoughts. And it's just like 100,000 snapshots of the inside of people's brains. And Facebook and other social media is such a powerful tool, but it's like a knife with a really, really sharp edge that can be used creatively for really good things, for people to reach out to networks of support, for political organizing, and for the empowerment of grassroots. But it can also be turned into a really dangerous echo chamber. Mm-hmm. And the vitriol that some people come out with is really like, nobody would say those things to you face to face, but somehow because they're behind a screen, it's somehow okay to be really, really horrible.
Yep. Even if you know them.
Yes.
Yeah. Like you
it's like a mask.
So sometimes I've had this really like alternative reality situation where someone's super, super rude on Facebook. And then I go to pick up my children from school and they're like, hi, like right next to me in the playground. Mm. Like, what are you doing for dinner? Do you want a play date with the kids? And I'm like, you literally
just slated you
not just slated me, but you tried to invalidate my whole being. And it's almost as if it's two different worlds for some people, but it's not, because it's real world anymore.
Simon, so you're the, I'd say the you know what? I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to say what you are. You can say what you are.
In what context?
So in I know you're very active on social media and you are political, but you're not, no one knows where you stand on. I'm not sure I know how you vote, which is, I know how most people, I've got a figure on how most people vote. I know how you two vote, but do you have the difficult conversations or do you just try and avoid them?
That's a good question. It depends who you're with, I suppose. I have conversations with friends about politics and stuff and at work and various other places. I won't avoid the conversation. I don't know whether this was part of the question, but I work in Burnley, for example, and all of my colleagues know that I'm Jewish. It's kind of one of the first things that I present, partly because I find it breaks the ice quite a lot, because when you're not somewhere that is a typical Jewish community, they are interested generally. That's quite nice. And then naturally politics will come up and various things around that. Difficult conversations. I've never really ended up in a particularly difficult or hostile conversation. Whether that's me not...
Let's start now!
whether that's because I've never taken it as a hostile discussion or whether I've actually just never been in one. I was on the BBC documentary, what was it called? We Are British Jews.
Oh, I thought I recognised you.
Yeah. And I was kind of pitched as the middleman again. Like, we didn't know where time would fall at the end of it. I was one of the northerners. I think there were three or two of us. And I was definitely right down the centre in everything, generally. That's kind of where I land politically. I wouldn't say that I'm affiliated with any particular party. My honest opinion is I think we should be voting on policies. We should be using technology more and be able to vote on policies rather than I have to decide that I'm Labour or I have to decide that I'm Conservative because of I agree for four things as opposed to one particular thing. So that's where I am politically. I don't know who I'm going to vote for in this current election.
So the one thing that you said was that there are people with extreme opinions. Does anyone think their opinion is extreme?
Yes. Yes, certainly.
My whole thing is combating extremism. And I have been accused of being extreme myself in my position. But no, I don't think I'm extreme.
Is that proving my point?
What I mean is I'm representing a position that is considered very extreme, yet it's not. To want to leave the European Union is not an extreme position. So I'm saying I believe in an extreme position because it is classed as an extreme position.
You've just said that you believe in an extreme position, but it's not an extreme position.
No, but from a nation's point of view, it is seen as the most worst decision, the worst opinion, the worst idea to have. For a long, long time, there's a lot of different views on it. Obviously, a lot of different ways to leave the European Union. My point is, I don't believe specifically that opinion is an extreme one, yet the rest of the nation does. So, well, I think this might be the problem.
Well, you say that, but yet, well, one, in terms of Brexit, a majority of the UK voted Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
Ergo, voting Brexit is not an extreme opinion. There is an argument that a no-deal Brexit is more a minority opinion.
I'd agree.
There is an argument that it's changed now. But without going down the rabbit hole of Brexit and Remain, it's interesting that you frame it as you think that you have an extreme opinion when evidence would suggest actually you don't.
No.
So is there a power in feeling like you're the outsider?
Yes. Absolutely. I'm told I'm an extremist. I have an extreme opinion all the time. The media tells me all the time. My friends tell me. I must be mad. Why would I want to do something so ridiculously extreme? Yet we were given the choice to make that extreme decision, which we normally don't. And to be fair, if we had a decision to jump off a cliff and all of us did it, we'd all say that's an extreme position, which obviously, yes, different situation. But
not
again,
so different.
Say it again.
Not so different.
Well, again, this is, depends how we debate that.
Has anyone around the table had an experience of someone with a perspective that you can then just can't talk to them anymore? And it's just, you've fallen out and that's it. And I'm meaning an extreme position rather than, yeah.
Yes, I've had views about questioning the legitimacy of the Holocaust and things like that. It's an area for me where I'd say, okay, I can't really debate with you on this. Which is for me, as someone, I feel like I'm a libertarian speaker. I like free speech. I think free speech is important. I wouldn't necessarily fall out with somebody. And I know people that's in my party that probably have some very warped views on what the Holocaust was. And again, with the Israel-Palestine conflict, we won't go into that. But I certainly wouldn't want to associate myself with people that have very strong opinions, whether that be towards the Holocaust, whether it to be towards homosexuality or individual rights, egalitarianism, which I consider myself to be a very egalitarian type of person. So I wouldn't necessarily not be friends with them, but I probably would not make an effort to be around them or debate with them or have much to do with them. I think it depends on the opinion. I think if something really affects you, and Brexit is an example, you know, there are people that will literally not speak to you because you voted this way. And it goes on, if you voted Remain, I know people that will not speak to you because you voted Remain because they think it's traitorous and all that sort of stuff. So I think it really depends on the opinion and depends on the fact and how close it is to your heart.
So I don't think it's how close it is to my heart. I think I would measure the harms. So if somebody has an opinion that promotes or impacts people in a really harmful, so it promotes harm or impacts people in a really harmful way, then I would probably in the first instance try and explain that to them. But some people just have sort of an idea, so that comes into Nachamu, my work with Nachamu, and that they have sort of an ideological, that's why they do everything that they do. It's ideologically inspired extremism. It's harms that they believe in, and they think that they're doing the right thing. So there's no explaining to people who think it's right to deny people autonomy. There's no explaining to people who think that women just should have to submit to their husbands. Those are sort of really harmful views, but they believe them from a really pure place. So that's not the sort of thing you can argue with.
Sometimes a religious place as well.
I try not to say religious, and I prefer ideological, because
fair enough.
It's my religion, and my religion doesn't say that you should rape women.
I wasn't sure if you were referring to, in terms of dominance, there's certain ideologies that believe it's okay to dominate women that way, and obviously I don't support that.
Right. That was a conversation stopper.
Well, normally the conversation stopper is people say, so what do you do, Yehudis? And I say, well, I work in sexual violence. And then everybody goes really quiet. And then I say, no, no, it's not that I perpetrate. Like, I don't act like, oh, right. And then we have to sort of shift. And someone starts talking about the fact that they work in recruitment or something like that.
Before we finish, I want to just circle back round and make sure that we've actually answered the question. I'm an ex-English teacher. I'm going to practice what I preach. In the context of the Jewish community becoming ever more polarised in our opinions, how do we remain friends at the end of it? So I feel like we've talked about the polarising in our opinions.
We've not talked about how we're going to be friends, though.
No, we haven't. We haven't talked about how we're going to be friends.
Yeah, good points. There we go.
Do we have to be friends? Is it necessary for the health of our community for us to be friends, or doesn't that really make a difference?
I think the community is ever changing. I think there's got to be a respect, certainly, and say an admiration for the roots of Judaism. But to say that we're all going to be friends is quite frankly ridiculous. I don't think you can expect to be friends with someone just because they're certain faith or community or ilk or class or whatever. They're always going to have different opinions. You're always going to break bread with different people. Define friends, I guess, really. What do you mean by friends? You mean people that you hang out with and people?
I mean, five people who live in two flats in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. I think I just got that.
You know. So I don't think we always have to be friends, but I do think we have to be civil.
Yes.
I mean, there's such ugly stereotypes about two Jews, three opinions. And there was a story recently that...
Do you think that's a negative?
Two Jews, three opinions, or stereotypes?
Do you think that's a negative? I didn't think it was a stereotype. What's it stereotyping? The fact that we have three opinions? I think that's a great thing, isn't it? It encourages debate, no?
Yeah, but it also shows that we're obnoxious know-it-alls, no?
Ah, so I didn't perceive that to be an obnoxious stereotype. I'd think that's a bit of a positive stereotype, personally. I mean, I don't know about you guys, and for me,
negative or positive stereotypes are not helpful because people are individuals. So to say something about that generalizes about a group of people and say, oh, Jews are like that, or oh, Muslims are like that, is just not helpful, and it's not a good starting point for good relationships. So we don't all have to be friends, but we do need to be civil. And I really think we also need to be kinder and thinking about the impact that when we hold strong opinions, are those strong opinions taking into consideration the impact that those positions have on other people? So we might think that in general, something's a really good idea. And policy-wise, that's how you'd like to see Britain in 15 years. But thinking about individual people who are almost always at the sort of bottom of the ladder, how's this going to affect the least advantaged people in society is how I would approach things.
How do you define civil? So there are people there are people in the Jewish community who say the Holocaust was a good thing.
Really?
Is it the Torah Carta?
The Turkana.
They say the Holocaust
was something along those lines. They want Israel to be bombed. You know,
well, I knew they were anti-Zionists. I didn't know they were Holocaust deniers as well.
No. They're not Holocaust deniers. And I know this because I was previously married to someone whose father talked like this. So the position is that the Holocaust was a wake-up call because Jews were falling into and assimilating, and we needed it to kind of press the reset button. And I think that's a horrible position to take. It's just horrible. But I don't think it's Holocaust denial.
No, fair enough, I clarified it.
But the question I was going to ask is what is civil in that regard? How would you be civil with someone like that?
It's going to be my question.
I don't know what the definition of civil is.
So I was married into that family for 11 years, and I think it was about sort of respecting each other as humans, like making sure they, you know, if I'm in their house, to a certain extent, conforming to their expectations. And if they were in my house, offering them food and drink. But I think that's basically where I drew the line.
Yeah, so
That's enough. That's good.
Yeah. And it's like the thing as well that I've personally become really conscious of is when someone says something that I find a bit awkward, the natural inclination is just to kind of have a nervous laugh.
Oh, but that's very British.
Yes.
Right.
Like it's not awkward isn't funny, is it?
Right. I've stopped myself doing it, though. Now I go, that's not okay.
Right. And there's a real reticence. People find it really hard to, when we talk about the call-out culture, but actually we don't have a call-out culture in the Jewish community. I mean,
Only on Facebook.
But, yeah. You know, well,
Calling out how? Certainly calling out anti-Semitism. We're certainly...
No, I mean, you could be at a community meeting and somebody would say something very inappropriate and everybody's kind of just shuts down and sort of glosses over and tries to move past the awkwardness. And there would be very few people who would say that's not okay.
True. The awkward laugh thing is interesting. I think I'm guilty of doing it myself. And I know what, I think it's just a laziness on my side. I know in my head that I don't agree with that opinion, but I just can't be bothered to tell.
Is that because you'd be doing it too much in the Brexit party? Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Boom. I think it's just, people are going to have their opinions. They're going to be wired that way. I mean, you know, I don't feel it's, I like to try and convince people or give them my views, my arguments to say why they're wrong or I think they're wrong. In their mind, they may not think they're wrong. But yeah, I think, I don't necessarily think it's a specifically British thing, but I think there is an awkwardness about that sort of uncomfortable laugh just to kind of move on. That's really why we do it. I think, as you said, Yehudis, I think more people need to probably challenge the opinion or challenge the view rather than just go, ha, 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 which I think probably all of us have been guilty of at least a few times.
I also think there's something to be said for doing it in the right way. If you're in a
public meeting,
I wouldn't expect anyone to call anyone out there and then, because I think that would put their backs
up. You pull them aside or something. You've got to be respectful.
Yeah.
So I actually disagree, because if there's a public meeting, or it might be not be open to the public, but there's a range of people around the table, it's really important to set the record straight then and there, because otherwise it kind of gets just glossed over and it doesn't help. So you can go to them afterwards at the end of the meeting and say, actually, I thought this, but people will have moved on and carried on in that direction. I'm not here because I need to tell people off, right? So other people changing their behavior doesn't really matter to me. For me, when I call someone out, it's because of the agenda. So if I'm saying we need more support services for people who have grown up their entire lives in the Haredi community and now don't have any skills for the workplace, there comes this, but they're happy that way. Mm-hmm. It's always me who puts my hand up and says, actually, not everyone is happy that way. And you have to call that out and you have to sort of move that discussion into where you want it to go. And talking about it later isn't going to help. And the second thing is, if somebody says something sexist or offensive right then and there, it's also important to call it out, because all those people around the table need to be in that moment with you, because people go off and experience that same moment that you experience, they'll experience it in different ways. But if you just can stop it right then and there and say, actually, no, it's not okay. It's not okay to donate a Sefer Torah and celebrate the memory of a sex offender or other things that I've challenged in the past in public places. You know, it's not okay. So please don't say that. And almost always that will be, not necessarily by the speaker, but will be well received by other people around them, because people say, I was thinking that, but I wasn't able to say it.
That's a good point. I certainly would agree with you. I think this shows how British I am. I think I probably would do it in a way that doesn't necessarily embarrass them, but they understand where they've gone wrong. I think I try to do it politely. I'm assuming you'd probably do the same.
Yeah, I'm not actually rude to people.
No, no, I know. But there are people that will say, well, actually, no, that's not right. Or, you know, just trying to, you know, I think, again, if something is really sexist or something like that, I'd hope that a lot of people would probably say something. A lot of people sometimes speak out of turn. Sometimes people say something they're not aware they've said it. And I think there's certain, again, you know, I don't know if I'm not always that type of person to correct somebody or to call out somebody if somebody said something in this context of a public meeting. But I think me being, I've always been in an office environment and I've always believed that until you can't talk about business on the shop floor, you know, you've got to pull people aside and I think that's my mentality. But I completely understand and appreciate where you're coming from. Completely. I think it takes a lot of gall to do something like that when a lot of people, you know, say, as you said, oh, I was thinking about doing it, but I didn't want to. You've done it for me anyway, Yodis, it's fine. But I think it's about how you challenge that opinion. And if you do it in a way that they're going to maybe realize, you know, you can do it in a right way, a respectful way, and they can probably more likely to realize they've said something out of turn rather than if you were to berate them and say, oh, you can't be saying that or whatever. You
yeah.
Know?
And I
hate what you're saying.
And there. I wouldn't, it's not a question of berating anybody. It's about offering them the opportunity to correct. Sidestep a yeah. little bit. Mm.
Fine.
And I think it's about presuming that they are good people who have just said something. Even if you think they're not, presuming that they're good can help, even if you think they might not be.
Yeah, and you asked me, Hayden, you asked me earlier, like, what do I do for fun? And I talk about these quite heavy topics all day. And I think that's exactly the point. Most people are good people.
Yeah.
And thinking about, you know, when it's hard, when it feels like you're swimming through treacle, when it feels like the whole world just doesn't want this community to be safe, that's not the case at all. It's hard for people to change. And a lot of people are just not brave enough to make changes that need to be made. And just assuming that people come from a good place is really helpful.
So all it needs is for me to thank Matt Mickler, Simon Jacobs and Yehudis Fletcher for joining me at the Bruegers today. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much,
thank
everybody,
you.
For having us.
That was nice and Bruegersy. A full interview with Yehudis and her experiences of the Haredi community is coming soon, and it's a corker. And now, to round off the episode, we have the soothing Talmudic tones of Rabbi Benji Stanley, recorded live at Limud Festival.
Talmud for Schmerls.
So for this Talmud for Schmerls, I'm joined by Rabbi Benji Stanley, who's a rabbi of Westminster Synagogue, which is an independent shul in the middle of London. No independence here, thank you very much.
I'll avoid that, Hayden.
What have you got for us today?
Right. So I want to talk about just a single statement in the Talmud. And this statement has become important to me because it raises questions and I think resolves them about why we learn altogether. I'm somebody who loves learning. I'm part of a Jewish culture that adores learning. And yet actually our assumptions of the importance of learning are, I think, unstable. At the Wannsee Conference in January 1942, 8 of the 16 high officials at that conference, when the final solution was first discussed, had PhDs. And so we might wonder about the relationship between learning and morals. And I think we want to say that our Torah is somehow different. And I think the line from Talmud teaches us how we can make our Torah different. So in Tractate Sota, page 14a, and I'll read it, just the statement in its entirety. Drash Rabbi Simlai, Torah tachilata gemlut hasadim v'sofa gemlut hasadim. Tachilata gemlut hasadim dikti v'yas Adonai Elohim la'adam ulishto kotnot or v'yalbishem. V'sofa gemlut hasadim dikti v'yikbor oto v'gai. So Rabbi Simlai interpreted, the beginning of Torah is loving kindness, and the end of Torah is the act of loving kindness. And he continues, the beginning of Torah is the act of loving kindness, as it is written, the merciful ultimate made skin or clothes for the skin of Adam and Eve and dressed them. And the end of the Torah is loving kindness because it seems that the eternal themselves buried Moses in the valley. And when we think about this Rabbi Simlai statement, we might wonder, what's he saying? How's he reading the Torah? What does it mean for the beginning and end of Torah to be loving kindness? So first of all, what is loving kindness? Earlier on in the page of Talmud, we get some lists of acts that could be considered loving kindness. There is clothing the naked, which could be to do with babies, although we think of it to do with the disadvantaged as well. There is visiting the sick, comforting the mourner, burying the dead. These are acts of loving kindness, sitting with the vulnerable, perhaps in your own vulnerability. And Rabbi Simlai initially may seem to be making a statement just about the content of Torah. The Torah begins with an act of loving kindness and it ends with an act of loving kindness. It begins with an act of loving kindness because the divine clothed Adam and Eve. And it ended with an act of loving kindness because the divine buried Moses. And then, like any good drush, any good interpretation, Rabbi Simlai is pointing us to really interrogate those texts. And we might think, dressing Adam and Eve was a great act of loving kindness. Yeah, in chapter 3 of Bereshit, you dressed Adam and Eve, having exiled them to a world of death for the transgression of eating the fruit, which could be considered, even in rabbinic terms, a light transgression. And Rabbi Simlai has compared these two episodes, and then we think about chapter 34 of Deuteronomy. Great act of loving kindness. You buried Moses in the valley. Yes, you buried Moses in the valley, having sentenced Moses to death for what could be considered a fairly baffling transgression, for hitting the rock. And so we see that Rabbi Simlai is actually pointing to the seeming severity of those two texts. And then we think further. So what is an act of loving kindness? It seems that in both those cases, God the parent sustains relationship even in the face of difficulty, is committed to presence in the face of profound vulnerability. And we realize too that the Torah begins with the clothing of babies and it ends with the burying of the dead. And it's as if Rabbi Simlai is teaching us the whole of the Torah is there to bring us closer to a single human being in the brevity of their life and to appreciate that they need kindness in that short span. And suddenly we realize that when Rabbi Simlai says that the beginning and end of Torah is loving kindness, he's talking about process and not just content. That actually to sit with something with commitment and presence in the face of difficulty is exactly what Rabbi Simlai is doing with the Torah. Determined to bring out the best, even when it hurts you, knowing that you can find something there which will make you a better person. And so Rabbi Simlai teaches us that the beginning of our learning occurs when we're committed to loving kindness and that we can take out of the text the guide to loving kindness so that its end will be loving kindness. And I finally think about this. You know, I wonder why this is important to me. And I know that one of the reasons I threw myself into Judaism was because when I was a teenager and I went to a big, scary school, had anxiety most days, stomach aches, and I grew to love the world of literature, listening carefully, thinking about what you want to say in the world. And I used to read all my essays every week or two to my elderly father, Jack Stanley, may his memory be a blessing, and he would criticize them. He was very sharp, and we would argue, and I would storm out, and I would make the changes that he suggested, and I would bring it back into him, and these would be moments when he was very, very proud. And I think that in those experiences, I saw the possibility of building interactions and a culture where your commitment to the person in front of you reinforces your commitment to wisdom in the past, and vice versa. And to do that, we need to build cultures where learning is oriented to people, oriented to kindness indeed, and also alive to orality so that we don't fall down in our echo chambers and fetishize the written word. And so I hope, Hayden, that we can all build a Torah of loving kindness.
Wow, Benji, Rabbi Benji Stanley, thank you very much.
Well, that's it. Hope you enjoyed. Until next time, bagelers.